Now, before we start, I wanted to give a shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie Colwin is a stress and mind-body coach in Los Angeles. You might remember that she guest hosted my podcast in January, and she came on live with me in August of 2021. She actually is one of the few people to actually see the garage gym live and in living color. Jeannie facilitates breath work to decrease stress, release stuck negative emotions, and decrease pain. Having trouble calming the monkey mind? She's your gal. It's not about controlling or managing your stress or thoughts. Instead, it's about shifting and improving the relationship you have with them. Jeannie spent 16 years battling fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and a myriad of other chronic symptoms that left her physically and mentally exhausted. She healed herself completely and is obsessed with getting her clients fast results through her one-on-one coaching program. Do you want to experience a live, full-length breathwork class with Jeannie and her incredible community? She's offering her next online breathwork class for free just for the mind and fitness community. The link to register to her next class on Sunday, March 27th, that's my birthday, is in the show notes. Use the promo code Mind and Fitness, no spaces, just Mind and Fitness, to register for free. Replays will be sent out if you can't attend live, and I would definitely encourage you to go. If you're going to do it for any reason, just do it because it is my birthday, 36 years old. So, link down in the show notes. Check Jeannie out. She's on Instagram. She's on Facebook. She does a lot of social media stuff. And again, the promo code Mind and Fitness. Thank you so much. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Before we get started today, I want to make sure that I give a shout out to the patrons of the show. There's almost two dozen of you, and I'm going to start with the most recent. So Amanda, Elise, Enda, Dominic, Sasha, Sylvie, James, John, Brooke, Jason, Mindy, Irina, Kelly, Tony, Michael, Anthony, Jen, and Nate, Christina, Ross, Julie, Brian, Arnie, and Barb. Thank you all so much for continuing to support the podcast. And if you are interested in supporting the podcast, helping keep the lights on, go to patreon.com/ The Mind and Fitness Podcast. Okay, so next week I am going on vacation, but that is not this week. So I had a really cool opportunity. Now, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, gosh, I want to say, when was this? This was back in the summer, maybe. I was asked by Dr. Douglas Gafrida, who is a professor at the University of Rochester in New York, to speak to one of his graduate classes. And I aired that. And then he asked me to come back. And so I was there last week. And I was actually there with Jessica Shahinian, who's been on the show before. But I got to speak to Dr. Gafrida or Douglas or Doug. I always get nervous when people have that accreditation and that title. What do I call them? So we'll say Dr. Gafrida. So I was I presented to his class and it was awesome. And I did it actually from a client of mine's office, which was pretty cool because I was out on the road. But that's what today's episode is going to be about. It's going to be about me speaking to the students. There's a couple of questions at the end. But a lot of it is I was asked to give kind of an abbreviated version of my story, but then talk about what are the things that I learned. And what I think is neat about this is if you listen to the one that I did previously, which again, I think was last summer, it's kind of like, what have I learned that's new in the last 8 or 10 months or whatever, you know, however long it's been. So I had a lot of fun there. I hope that he invites me back. I always have a blast talking to him and his class. So without further ado, here I am speaking to, Dr. Douglas Gafrida's class in the graduate program at the University of Rochester.
And by the way, I think we're going.
Yeah, we're going. By the way, the big push to have this recorded is simply because, podcast content is very tough, and sometimes there are just weeks where things get a little wild and schedules are full, and having just evergreen content is really nice. One of my favorite shows as a kid was Home Improvement, and there was an episode where Tim, the Toolman Taylor, the main character, it was called, I think the name of the episode was Professor Tim. He was given an honorary PhD in something, so I called that episode Professor Lindenstein, as because I was speaking at, you know, Rochester, and I don't know, whatever, dumb dad joke. Well, thanks for having me again. Jessica, it's nice seeing you again. I got introduced to do you want to call you Doug, or do you want me to call, what would you prefer?
Yep, Doug is fine. Thanks.
Okay. Somebody had actually sent me, I'm not really active on Twitter. It's not something that I use for promotion for the podcast at all, but it was maybe, I don't know, 2 years ago, I got this DM from somebody that said, hey, I found your name in one of the publications. I think it was Counseling Today or something like that. And I had never heard of that publication. I went to the website. I got in touch with them. I found an archive. I saw where it was mentioned. That was how I found Doug's name. And we've been connected ever since. And it's been really nice. But I've been entrenched in this mind body community now since October of 2017 as an active voice in the community. Today, actually, episode 215 of my podcast dropped, which is just, it's crazy to think about. And in the first few weeks I was doing it, I remember it was really tough to even find 20 people to listen to it or 30 people to listen to it. I remember when I hit 50, which was probably after 10 or 12 episodes or so, it was like, you know, this is huge. And if this is all that I ever do in this space, I'll be incredibly proud. And now at this point, it's 15, 20,000 people listening every single week all around the world in countries that I've never heard of, where I'll look at a map and I'll go, oh, I never heard of Burkina Faso, or I'd never heard of Malta, or I'd never heard of some of these other places. And so that's been really rewarding. So before I get into all of this, just know that if I could turn, and I know that at 36, my life is not over by any means, but if I could go back to, I just drove by my university and I'm never in this area. I'm at a client's office actually right now. They donated an office for me to do this. This is the line of work I would have loved to have gotten into if I could turn back time to when I was in college. So there's a really great opportunity. It was nice hearing everybody's background, in this. So, do you think just chronologically, is that sort of what you're thinking, Doug?
I thought you gave a really nice, very, you know, tight synopsis of your own history that I think was really helpful. But the thing we kind of got cut short last time that I would have loved to have heard more about is all the things you've learned. You started sharing about different things you've learned through the podcast, people you've interviewed, different stories. You've had a lot of clients, you know, our former patients come on. So yeah, let's hear your story. But also, I want to hear about your expertise. And I think it all kind of came pretty naturally that you wove it together well. I just want to give you some more space this time to do it.
Yeah. So I'm a weightlifting athlete. I train competitively. I haven't competed. I mean, COVID sort of threw that in the gutter, at least for the time being, because there's no spectator sports. But in Olympic-style weightlifting, which is, if you watch the Olympics, it's the only barbell or iron or strength sport that is featured. So I've been doing that since 2012. And then at the end of 2015, I sustained an injury to my shoulder. I dislocated my shoulder and it took several months to go by to actually get some MRI imaging and get a confirmed diagnosis, quote unquote. And I ended up going in and having surgery on that. This was sort of the first time where I was a little bit conflicted on kind of Western medicine and sort of how that model is, especially in the United States, around treatment protocols. And just like, if you have two doctors looking at the same picture, meaning an image, their stories are completely different and what's actually going on is completely different. And how could that be? So that was really sort of like kind of the groundwork and a lot of how I think about mind body medicine today is really questioning and kind of prodding a little bit and just being like, Eddie, are you sure about as many things maybe as you used to be? And that's going to be a big theme that I want to talk about today that I didn't get to touch on as much last time. So I had a shoulder repair done and they had quoted me 8 to 10 months of rehab before I could return to compete, before I could return to training again. I rehabbed like a madman. I was headed towards full unrestricted activity at 4 months and 29 days. That's a TMS personality trait, is sort of that perfectionism, rehabbing like a man, and then also just having to beat whatever it is that the goal is. That's perfectionism at its core. As time went on, as we got into the last week or so, a week or couple of weeks before I was about to get cleared, I started having a variety of different types of symptoms, ones that I didn't have before. I was having sciatic pain going down my leg. I was getting a lot of numbness in my foot. And, again, it was just something I hadn't experienced before. It was on the opposite side of the body. You know, it was a left shoulder injury that I had done all this rehab for, yet it was my right leg and the right part of my back now that's giving me all of these issues. So I just kind of chalked it up to overuse or overtraining. And then you kind of start to think about, oh, maybe I picked up something, or I did something, or I overdid it months before, you know, kind of the games that we play with ourselves on what could be causing certain things. I went back and saw the surgeon who operated on my shoulder, and he said, I don't really know. I ended up going to see a variety of different doctors. And this is kind of where, I mean, I spent the next several months just every single week. It was usually a doctor, a physical therapist, a couple of chiropractors, and maybe like a massage therapist or a Rolfer or something like that, that I would see throughout the week. So this went on for 6 months or so, 7 months or so, 8 months or so. I ended up having a procedure done on my neck. I drove from Seattle to Helena, Montana, which was a 13-hour drive or something like that. Had a procedure done on my neck. I drove home feeling worse than when I came there, which it's like a real gut punch when you go all this way, you pay all this money, it's not covered by insurance, you feel worse coming home. It was just kind of like over and over again. And the feeling that I had had for so many months, where I felt like, okay, I would wake up in the morning and I would say, Eddie, the doctor that you're seeing today is the one that's going to solve the problem. Then I would go and see it. They'd give me what maybe their thoughts were, but didn't really have any answers. And I would go home just feeling crushed. And so this was every day for months on end. I went and had EMG studies done. Doctor shared what he felt was going on. It showed some real disruption and quite a few nerves within inside of my neck and in my arm and in my back. Wanted to refer me to a neurosurgeon. I was just kind of like, I haven't been able to pick up a barbell in months at this point. I couldn't ride my motorcycle anymore because I would just have too much tingling in my hands to do it. And those are my two biggest loves, at least at the time, they were my two biggest loves. And I couldn't do either one of those anymore. There was a story in the local news here in Seattle. Two chimps at our big local zoo, Woodland Park Zoo, had gotten into a fight. This is a great story that I would say maybe to go and Google at some point, because it's kind of cool to see how did I come across this doctor. There was a story of two chimps that had gotten in a fight at the Woodland Park Zoo, and they brought in a doctor she's actually the head physician for the University of Washington Huskies football team, Dr. Kimberly Harmon. She was in the news because she had, in a non-operative way, had healed these chimps. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. Maybe I'll give her office a call. She's at UW. She's an orthopedic. She works with athletes. We'll see. So I call the office and they tell me there's like a 6-month wait list or something like that. So like, okay, well, put me on the list, I guess. And a couple days later, they called me and said, we just had a cancellation. If you can get here within an hour, you can see her today. And I dropped everything, canceled all my client meetings, raced down to the stadium so I could see her. Can you guys hear me okay, by the way? Okay. So I race down and I see her. I bring all my imaging with me. I bring the MRI of my neck. I bring the x-rays of my neck and my back. I bring the EMG studies that I had just had done. She was really the first doc. I mean, at this point, I'd seen probably 20 or 25 different medical professionals, and I'd say 10 or 12 of those were medical doctors, really well-respected medical doctors. That in retrospect, you kind of think back, or I think back, and I'm like, most of them would give me 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, because that's the way that it is here, unfortunately. There's not a lot of time there. I think Dr. Harmon spent almost an hour with me. She looked at all the imaging. She saw this. She did strength tests. She looked at where these disruptions in the nerves and anything like that, and really just started asking me about my life and asking me about stress that may be involved in my life. What's my day-to-day look like? Asked me if I felt stressed. And I was like, no, I don't feel stressed. And she said, okay, well, tell me about do you have any kids? Yes, I have one daughter. At the time, she was not even three yet. She was like two and 7/8, basically. So told her about that. Said, what do you do for work? And I said, I'm in software sales. And, you know, kind of on and on and on, asked me about the shoulder injury. But she had just kind of planted this little seed, where I kept literally pushing these tests physically with my hand and saying, if these tests, there's nothing about stress on here. And she said, I don't care what the tests say. She gave an example of like a wide receiver, you know, University of Washington, we're not very good right now, but I'm a season ticket holder. We've been good and we still have a lot of lineage. You know, she explained to me, stories of like wide receivers that are used to having big games every Saturday, 10 catches, 120 yards. And she said, there may be an instance where a receiver has four drops, they have 15 yards. They have just a really poor game. And said, as soon as they're done with that game, we come back on Monday and I will send them to the sports psychologist for the team. She's like, because if we don't, we may start seeing injuries popping up in the next couple of weeks. And I just thought, like, that's a really interesting way of putting it. Left the office just very befuddled, like just very confused, because it was the first, every other doctor I had gone to see, usually I would walk out with a prescription for either an anti-inflammatory or some kind of painkiller. So it would be an oxy or something like that. And normally I didn't take them. I took them after my shoulder surgery, but that was really it. I just wasn't a big believer in that kind of stuff. So she gave me the number for the sports psychologist, who I didn't actually call because the idea now was in my head. A few weeks went by. I still wasn't lifting anymore. And I'm sort of like a shell of my former self physically and then also just mentally. And this, you know, this is peak riding season. We don't get very many nice months in Seattle. And so to miss out on riding my motorcycle for so long at this point, it's almost like a religious experience, which probably sounds crazy to some of you, but it really is. And so to not be able to do any of the stuff that I love to do, was crushing, like, over and over. A few weeks went by and I was on Amazon searching for something relating to back pain. And this, a suggested purchase of Dr. Sarno's Healing Back Pain was there. And it just, the reviews were crazy. I mean, I think at the time it had 1600 or 1700 reviews and this like 4.7 out of 5-star rating, which, I mean, people are miserable on the internet. So you could find any sort of a book and everything's so polarizing. Either it's terrible or it's great, but to find anything where there's such a universal appreciation and love for this one book that has 2000, you know, was written in 1997 or 1999 or something like that. So it's like, it's been around for a long time. It led into me looking at YouTube videos and finding the 2020 story and, just finding other people's accounts. I eventually led into thankyousarno.org, which if you're not familiar with that, I would say to check that out. It's letters that people would write Sarno over his entire career to say, I had problem XYZ. I had 7 ruptured discs. I had, and Jessica's going to talk about stuff. I had Jessica on my podcast a couple of years ago, and I could not believe some of the stories that she was telling me. And then I have all these other people that come on and say very similar stories. So like, it is a thing. And if you would have told me 2 months before I saw Dr. Harmon, hey, this book could really end up influencing you, or even just to suggest or float over to me that, emotions could tie into physical pain, like, I would have slammed the door in your face or hung up on you or deleted you from Twitter, whatever, as fast as possible. But it totally changed a lot of things. So I was obsessed with Sarno's work. And it really, I mean, I think I bought his book on like a Thursday, which, by the way, I found his book, it might have been a day or two before he died. Like that, it was almost sort of like a sign from the universe. Like, you've got to find this guy's work before he passes away. Because then I start searching for him, and then it's an obituary. And I was just like, this just happened. And this is the summer of 2017. So we're 5 years removed from this now. So I spent the next 2 nights just glued to this book. And again, I hadn't touched a barbell since January at this point. I had totally just given up. I said, until I can find a doctor that can cure me 100%. I'm not going to go back to my sport. And, which again was just, it's a crushing blow. Tough to describe, actually, if you've worked on something every single day for 10 years, and then not be able to do it just sucked. So, I went back to the gym the next Monday as if nothing had ever happened. And it was amazing. I didn't have from that day. I mean, I wasn't totally over my pain or symptoms, and we'll kind of get into that in a little bit, but I would say a good sizable 60-70% reduction in symptoms just over the weekend, just from the knowledge of having the, and again, I was so hard-headed leading into that, that it just felt like there was really no way that anything like this could ever be possible. And it sounds really cheesy, but I went back to the gym and I was just so convinced that mind over matter is not the right way to put it, but that's really how I felt and sort of my quest to get back into my sport. I started riding my motorcycle again. I started doing all that again. And I had kind of misinterpreted Sarno's message at first because I kind of upended my life. I quit my job. I was paid very good money for the job that I was doing, 6-figure job. I had a lot of respect and I had a lot of equity in. But I thought that the message was almost like, you need to change these things about you. And though I think there is some change that has to be necessary, it doesn't have to be the big life moves like that. But the whole plan was that I was going to stop doing that and I was going to start this podcast. And from that podcast, I was going to get all these clients flooding to me that wanted to learn about fitness. And I'd basically become an online personal trainer, which didn't end up happening. But I did start the podcast. So that's sort of like the pain story. And as far as kind of how the next few months rolled on, again, I started doing the podcast. It was called the Eddie Knows Fitness Podcast. And I had a fitness guru or two to start out, a bodybuilder. But it wasn't hitting. Like, people weren't as into it. And then I started having people like Nicole Sachs was on, and then Steve Ozanich was on. And it was just like literally week after week, I would just have these different personalities on. If you go to the PPTA website, it's like a who's who of the people I've had on my show. So later, when you listen to Jessica talk about the organization, if she's going to talk about it, if you like some of what she's saying, not only is she on it, but every other doctor pretty much that's affiliated is on it too. Dr. Schubiner was on it. I mean, essentially everybody in the space but Sarno, basically at this point, has made it onto the podcast in some sort of way. Some of the themes, who had brought up somatics, that's a part of what they, that, okay. Missy. Okay. So some of the things maybe that I didn't get to talk about the last time that I came on, because I did some of the back end story, and you can feel free to ask questions or anything like that, things that maybe I have missed. Of all the different things that I have learned about in reading books and talking to experts and doing the podcast itself, because it is very much like going to school every single week when I do an interview with a new person. I've got probably 300 hours of content of this topic over the last 5 years. I'd say that at this point in time, the thing that I personally believe the most in is like acceptance, knowing that you're okay, and that even the things that are legitimate injuries will heal and you will be fine tomorrow, as opposed to everything is life or death, which is very much how I treated life before any of this. But then also, a couple of concepts were floated to me by a therapist that I personally worked with. Floated a concept called alexithymia, which, if you know who Jim Prusak is, he's also talked a lot about this recently, but kind of the idea of basically like some people, something really sad happens and they can sit there on the couch and cry about it for days and days and days. And I never thought I would say that I'm envious of people that can actually like kind of have a predisposition to be able to feel certain things, because the symptoms that I would get for the 20 years or 25 years leading up to the shoulder injury were all things that, to me, like, I wouldn't cry over events. You know, my grandfather dies, I'm at his funeral, I can't bring myself to cry, but then suddenly I get intense asthma issues, or I get a lot of knee issues, or I get a lot of shoulder issues, or whatever the case may be. One of the exercises that I did after I found Sarno's book, and this wasn't a prompt by him, and I think maybe another author in the space did recommended something like this later on, but I just went through and did an inventory of like, what is every injury or illness or issue that I can think of that I've had in the last, you know, as long as I could remember, probably since I was 7 or 8. And then, and the other column, like on the other side of the paper, what was going on in my life around that time? And it was just this really interesting intersection that you would find, especially in my professional life. So after I finished college, so 22, where I would get some kind of a orthopedic injury in either, it would either be March, June, September, or December every year, like clockwork. That went on for 10 years. And then going back and thinking about it, knowing that, okay, my whole professional life, I've been in sales in some way, and those are always the end of every single quarter. So it's like the tea kettle is filling professionally. And I end up with some kind of a mind body issue. But over time, I mean, I developed really bad asthma as a little kid. I mean, I lived on a daily cocktail of 3 or 4 different prescriptions for asthma and allergies that I took every day for years and years and years. And that was one thing that I just stopped cold turkey after I found the Sarno book, and I haven't had an issue since. So these are things that like was mandatory or felt like it was mandatory that I take every single day. You know, you go on, like, I remember going to Australia for 3 weeks in 2012 for a vacation with my wife, and like scrambling to make sure that I could get all these prescriptions filled before I took this trip. And these are for, you know, when I think of traditional like mind body issues, I think of like headaches and back pain and shoulder pain, like joint issues. I didn't think of things like asthma and allergies and stuff like that, but there's just been so many issues that I've solved, with these things. And I think that maybe the number one, I'm getting back to the somatics part, maybe the number one tool that I feel in my toolkit at this point in time is somatic tracking out of the Alan Gordon playbook, if you're familiar with any of his work. What's some other things? One of the bigger lessons, too, that I would say, actually, I want to come back to somatics for a second. Because when I describe this to people that aren't familiar with any of this kind of work, like somatic experiencing or even just experiencing feelings in your body and understanding maybe what that feels like, has anybody seen, I've seen it post, and maybe it's just I'm kind of looking for it now, but online there's like body charts that show these like flames or blue, or they're showing emotions in the body is the whole idea. Like that's what it's supposed to be. And now I can very much identify those and what do feelings even feel like in the body. And so like part of the nightly ritual, and I haven't been as good about it lately, and it is what it is. But when I really get into like a good zone of somatic work, I'm talking like 2 to 3 minutes a day, maybe at most, right before I go to bed. And I equate it, and the way I think about it is like, there's a great scene in Apollo 13 where all the astronauts are trying to get back to Earth, and they basically turn on these burners, and that rocket is going as fast as possible. They're using every single resource possible to get closer to Earth, to where it is that they need to be. And that's how I treat somatic work, like really feeling everything within myself. And it's like 2 or 3 minutes. And at the end, I feel like I've gone through a war, but any sort of joint pain or issues, injuries, hurts, pains that I felt in the body are gone. I mean, they vanish just like that. And it's really, it's so, like if anybody in this office right now that doesn't know me is listening to me talk, they probably think I'm nuts. But, you know, that's why it's so important. The work that all of you are doing is to help the world know that it's not crazy and it does totally all work because it's the way things work. And if I had to say like maybe the biggest thing that I've learned throughout all of this over the last few years is really like that the things that you think are most certain or that you know the most about or that, just in life in general, really like, you don't know anything is kind of how I always, it's kind of how I thought about it. Like even stuff that's recent, like with the pandemic or how I felt about vaccines or how I feel about masking or how I feel about social etiquette or anything like that. Sort of taking a step back just for my own mental health and understanding like, hey, everything that I was so certain about 1 year ago, none of that may be true right now. And I think about that a lot with just how I handled and navigated through the mind body space. Cause again, when Dr. Harmon brought this concept to me that emotions or stress can and will lead to really physical issues that have nothing to do with the images that they could take. We could all take images of our hips. And I bet that 75 or 80% of us, maybe even more, are going to have these degenerative issues that any doctor could see on an MRI, but none of us may have hip pain or back pain or whatever. It's just really questioning the things that you think that you know. And the people that I've talked to and worked with in my personal, because this isn't something that I don't go on Facebook every day and write the latest revelation that I learned about mind body syndrome. I did for the first like 6 months that I knew about any of this stuff. Nobody wanted to hear it, or they said it wasn't real, or they said, hey, my issues are actually real, talking about themselves. So I kind of stopped talking about it, but every so often I would get these messages from people that I knew that a lot of times they're athletes, cause that's kind of the circle that I'm in. And they would say, I've had this tennis elbow that's been going on for months and I'm supposed to compete in this powerlifting. Like there was a woman, Rachel Egner. So she's in her 50s. She's in her early 50s or maybe even late 40s. She was a competitive powerlifter 10 or 15 years ago, started having this elbow, bicep, shoulder issue that was going on a couple of years back. Couldn't compete anymore. Sort of felt like a shell of her former self. Said, I feel like I saw you talk a year or so ago about this podcast you do. And I'm like, yeah. What do you want to know? And just, I wasn't bringing anything forward. I wanted her to just ask the questions. And so I would answer her, and I guided her a couple of resources that I think, you know, you can spend 20 minutes looking at these resources. And if you think it's a bunch of bullshit, then don't look anymore. And if you think it's really interesting, then I can lead you to some more places. I mean, like 6 months later, she's setting world records for rowing, and powerlifting and deadlifts and bench and squats and all this stuff at her age, and her problems totally cured. I get emails from people all the time, again, around the world that are listening to this podcast that I do that have these crazy stories. There was my TimeHop app on my iPhone a couple of days ago, reminded me of this woman, Mindy Patterson. Her son who was in college at the time. He might even still be. I think he actually just graduated. Played high school basketball, scholarship athlete, played college basketball, started having intense pain issues, could not get right, left basketball, scholarship went out the window because of this. Doctor diagnosed him with, diagnosed him with compartment syndrome. If you're ever told that by a doctor, by the way, don't Google it because the images for compartment syndrome are miserable, but that's what the doctor told him he had, which is terrifying if you ever do come across the images. Somebody had told him about my podcast. He sent me a DM on Facebook. I talked to him for a couple of days. I didn't hear from him after that. And maybe 6 months later, I got this message from his mom that said, "Hey, you talked to my son Brandon last year when he couldn't play basketball anymore." And she said, "He's back playing. He's back as a scholarship athlete, and he doesn't have any symptoms anymore." So, like, you know, they're in Ohio. Like, it's just there's people all over the place. Yeah, I don't know. It's kept me with a very open mind about even stuff that's not mind-body related, that like, hey, the things I've been so sure about in my life really they don't equate much to anything because everything is subject to change.
That's awesome, Eddie. So you want to take some questions now?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Jessica, feel free to jump in too. He interviewed you. This gives you a chance to get back at him. So you can either put stuff in the chat or just kind of raise your hand. I'll put a different view up so I can see you all.
Yeah, make it tough. Whatever you
Jessica, have. I see you unmuted. Do you want to get us started?
I'm digesting it all. I mean, yeah, our interview was back in 2019 and life was so different back then, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I know for me, and you touched on this a bit through what you were saying, it's fascinating how you have your initial revelation or aha moments, and then as time goes on and you keep using your toolkit to address your mind-body symptoms, simultaneously interviewing others about how they helped theirs, you not only reinforce the tools you already had, but you add more tools to your toolkit. And looking back on that, like commenting on the fact that like the more you know, the more resourceful you are in your self-care that everyone needs to have. But for you, especially dealing with alexithymia, the inability to properly identify your emotions or fully kind of feel them emotionally versus somatically, what did that feel like? Is it typically easier for you to manage symptoms as they pop up now than it was in your first year of knowing about this? Like, what was that growth like?
Yeah. So, what this makes me think of is in college, I worked in programming at ESPN Radio, in Seattle, and, we had a 7 second delay and a dump button in case somebody used a curse word. So, an athlete or somebody says something bad and we have 7 seconds to toss it off the air. And that's kind of how I feel, pun intended. That's kind of how I feel like, emotions or instances get to me, almost like I sort of like, I'll give you a real world example right now. And I've cried enough about this in the last couple of days that I don't think anything's going to happen here, but if it does, bear with me. We put our, dog down in 2019. He was 13 years old. He was the greatest dog ever. His little brother turns 13 this Saturday. However, his variety of different health issues have gotten kind of to a place where I felt I needed to call the vet yesterday, and we're going to go do it's called a quality of life exam on Monday, but basically, hey, make a recommendation that does Barkley still, is there enough for him to live for at this point? And I, with everything, am fully expecting us to probably put him down before the end of next week. So watching him deteriorate over the last month or so, I've been feeling just a variety of symptoms, but again, thinking that I'm at the tail end of my weightlifting cycle. In fact, it wraps up this Friday. I've been working for 9 consecutive months on this cycle. So the automatic assumption is that I'm getting to the end of this weightlifting cycle. And that's why I just feel so destroyed in so many different parts of my body right now. But then a couple of days ago, as I'm reflecting, Barkley sitting beside me at my desk while I'm working, and I'm just kind of looking at him in the eye. Well, not in the eyes because he's asleep, but I'm looking at him and just sort of realizing like, it's not the weightlifting cycle. Like, it's what you're thinking about with this dog, and not just the impact of like, he was the first dog I ever adopted, but that my kids love him so much. and just watching them with him. So I start thinking more about that, and the pains start to go away. So just, it's almost like instances or emotions, like sort of watch them pass. And then I have an issue like what's going on in my back or whatever. And it's like, ooh, it's the dog, and like literally grabbing it out of the air. And once I can do that, then the pains go away. And it's sort of, it's very cheesy, but I'm a superhero nerd. And I see it as very much like a superpower, like this kind of stuff. Cause it really is like the key to wellness is this. I mean, I observe so many people that I know, friends and family, that they just kind of seem like they're a little bit out of control, with, you know, they have a symptom, their back hurts or whatever. And then they're going to a doctor and they're posting online and they're reading this book. They're taking that supplement. They're just, you know, they're getting it. They're going to see a physical therapist twice a week. They're seeing a chiropractor three times a week, and it's taking them for the ride, right? Like somebody else is living their life at this point. And in a way I feel like it, it almost, makes me feel like maybe like I lack empathy or compassion sometimes, because I'll have friends that start, like my two best buddies, they're complaining about back pain constantly in our group thread or a group text. And usually I just don't say anything when they kind of get into this 30 or 40 minute complaining session about their different bodily aches. And then I wait till they send some stupid video off of TikTok, and then I can resume being in the conversation. But it's, I feel like, Jess, got to go back and answer your question. I do feel like very much it is, it's like a superpower. So that's one thing. Maybe it just means that, and I don't, like, he didn't give a formal diagnosis of alexithymia, but he had said the word. And then when I heard Jim Prusak say it on a YouTube video a month ago, and I was like, holy shit, because I took the note and I went and found the note that Dr. Hopps, the psychologist that I work with, had said, and I was like, huh, like maybe that's something. And another one, and this is sort of a trauma related, but one thing that my therapist had also brought up was that he floated an idea to was adjustment disorder. So there might be like a hint of that going on. I'd never heard about it. So I Googled it and I was like, it doesn't really fit me entirely. Or I didn't think it did. But he, in our next session, when I asked him about that, because that's one thing too, is like, it's got to be kind of aggravating for like a therapist to be like, I'll call myself like a wannabe therapist, right? So he's giving me like real therapy work, and I'm sort of spouting back these things that I've learned about on a podcast that I do, right? I don't know. It's got to be like a mechanic being told by the guy who brought his car, and here's how to fix my car. But I had brought up, or he had brought up adjustment disorder because of an event that happened in 2006 when I was 20, where I had a girlfriend who faked a pregnancy a couple of times, actually. And that there was some, I mean, certain behaviors or hesitancies that I've had in relationships since then that, I mean, it's like literally you turned a switch off in 2006, just in terms of overall trust levels and willingness to, you know, just, it's just very strange. Like, going back and just thinking about this event, yes, it was a big event in my life and the biggest one in my life at that point in time, but how we're 16 years removed from that, and it's still impacts me in a pretty big way, that, you know, trauma is a real thing. So though I do very much believe that TMS can be too much stress, and it really could be that your day to day. But it's rooted, like there's a root there somewhere. There's definitely a root there somewhere.
I just wanted to follow up, Eddie, on a couple things you said. Well, the first one was I use the analogy with my clients, especially the ones that are better, like not in pain anymore, because they still get shots of pain. Everybody who's mind body symptoms, it's never, it's always a part of who you are. It just becomes what I use the analogy is a check engine light. Mm-hmm. Like you were saying, okay, my back's starting to hurt. There must be something I'm not paying attention to, right? It's like that check engine light coming on saying, hey, pay attention. You don't, to fix the car, when the check engine light comes on, you don't disconnect the wires to the light or cover it up with tape, right? You have to slow down, stop, do a full diagnostic of what's going on inside the engine. And I see chronic pain as in the same way as the light. You don't go for the pain for mind-body people, which I think is about 30% of us in the world. You go for understanding fully what might be going on. When people are actually better, they'll get these little shots and it doesn't become, just like you said, it doesn't become something because now they go, oh, could there be some more grief going on maybe some anger about that little thing at work that didn't seem like much at the time, but maybe it's triggering something that is a big deal for me that happened before or something. So
there was that what that brings to mind is this was like, and yeah, absolutely. Even though I found this stuff 5 years ago, like I still have, you know, I'm human. Nicole Sachs talks about like she has a cure for chronic pain. She doesn't have a cure for human pain. And so we're all going to have things. And I think that the sooner that you can get to that realization, as I get lots of people very frustrated with some of the things, you know, I bring somebody on the podcast and the person says they read a book and they were better in a weekend or whatever. It's not often, but it's happened. So I've been working on this for 6 months and nothing's changed. And, or they say I've been doing this for 8 months and now I have this other issue and everything. And it's like, well, here's the thing. Like, the sooner that you can just get to a place that like whatever happens, happens, like, and kind of like it is what it is, like the better it's going to be for you, like the better the overall experience is going to be for you. And there was an instance like, it was probably about a year ago, where I was training in my garage. That's where I've trained since the pandemic started. And I had lifted a barbell. It was a weight that I had done easily several times. There was nothing special about it. I think it was even like a warm-up set. And I felt like somebody just took like a hot bat or a hot knife and like just stuck it in my lower back. And my legs just went out from underneath me. Like I could not walk. Like I could not move. It was the most intense and profound pain other than the skateboarding accident I had a couple of years ago. It was just like, I was in the fetal position, meaning that like I was laying flat on the ground, but my legs were up as if I was sitting on a chair. And I just can't imagine like 5 years prior, if that same thing happened, like it would have been a 911 call immediately. And there would have been an ambulance there taking me to the hospital. And who knows how far that would have gone. Cause I would imagine myself in the weeks after that, like sitting in a hospital bed and they're giving me all sorts of different injections and things like that and diagnosing me with things. Cause like, yeah, like I've been weightlifting really hard and I've had motorcycle issues. I've been rear-ended by drunk drivers. Like I know if you took an image of my whole spine, that thing probably looks disgusting. It's probably shot in a lot of different ways, but it doesn't mean that it's what's going on with any sort of pain that I have. So I have this issue. I'm laying on the ground and I, instead of calling 911, I army crawled to I call him my TMS buddy, but he's my friend Brad, who went through all the same stuff. He's an athlete. And I just text him to tell him like, here's the situation. And he said, well, what's been going on lately? And we were just kind of talking about this and, little by slowly back starts to feel better. I can stand up. I can go do things. I took my normal resting day the next day, which was planned anyway, but I was back in the gym 2 days later. Whereas if you were to tell me, if this were to happen again 5 years ago, I mean, I could have been out for a year chasing doctors. I couldn't move my legs. Like I can't even let's say that I was sitting here doing this Zoom with a bunch of English majors and I told them that same story, people would be horrified. You guys are all nodding because you know that like the jig is up. One thing that Dr. Schubiner told me when I interviewed him is he was asking me about like, he asked me about the times when my symptoms would really like flare up the most, like what activities was I doing? And I had said that when I would lift a barbell, my hands would go numb. And when I would lean onto my motorcycle, my hands would go numb. And he would say, does it, meaning the brain or meaning the distraction, does it have your attention now? That's all he would say. And I just thought like, yeah, like for real. Because a lot of times when I talk to people and they say these physical issues they have, it's preventing them from doing something. It has to get their attention. Otherwise, they're not going to care. And like they need to care.
Eddie, you also mentioned alexithymia a couple times, and it might be helpful for us to just kind of define it and then talk about the implications for some of our work with folks. So just the idea that people, it's a mental health diagnosis that it means you essentially people have a difficult time identifying, recognizing, understanding emotions. And I know Mark Lumley, either of you ever worked with Mark? He's one of Howard Schubner. Oh, Eddie, you should interview him next. He helped Schubner develop emotional awareness and expressive therapy, and he's published quite a bit on it. Mark's done some work on alexithymia that I've read about and the implications for it with pain. And so you were saying, you know, we wonder. I mean, typically those folks, many of my clients wouldn't be that drastic. They know and recognize emotions. They can talk about them. They just don't feel them. They don't experience them. They recognize it. They know I'm mad. They can tell me that they're mad. I say, how do you experience it in your body? They say nothing, or, oh, I'm tight, you know?
Yeah. The only time, yeah, his exact wording, Dr. Hopps, the therapist I work with, that he had said was, it sounds like there could be some alexithymia going on. You know, like, there could be something going on. Like, it reminded me of, like, a Curb Your Enthusiasm quote, kind of how he said it. It might have just been what he was using to describe, but I think it's totally like that, where I, like, in the past, when I can remember angry, like, events that I should have been, you know, other people might have been, like, throwing chairs across the room or breaking windows or whatever, like, I'm just sitting there emotionless. I say to people as a joke that I'm dead on the inside, and that's why. And that's why I don't react to stuff like that. The only time I can ever remember, like, having visceral reactions where, like, tears would come or I could feel it in my body, it's only with, like, happy stuff. Like I'm a big how far is Rochester from Brooklyn? I know nothing about New York.
I'm maybe a 5 or 6 hour drive.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm a big pro wrestling nerd. It's just my thing. There was a big event in Brooklyn in 2015, and there was this great story that had been told over, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years. And there were these two women that wrestled this match, and the story that was told throughout the match was so perfect. There was an element of bullying in it. There was an element of the person who's kind of a shithead human being is getting the upper hand. And then there's this underdog woman, looks just like my daughter, who overcomes this dastardly villain. And the bell rings and the match is over and my wife is sitting next to me and I just start, I'm like about to burst into tears. They're coming down. I couldn't even, if this were today, I wouldn't have had a problem. I would have just looked at Jenny and she would have said, why are you crying? And I would have said, it's just, there's so many parallels where I feel this. So it was only situations like that where I could really like express an emotion. And one thing that I make sure I say on as many podcasts as I can is that Sarno's book, he talks about repression, repression, repression. And so a lot of people tend to then think that the opposite of repression would be to express, right? So they go, like Seattle's got a couple of these places where, maybe they have these in New York, where you go there and they've got like a VCR and glass and stuff, and they'll give you a sledgehammer and you can like destroy stuff. Like that's the whole thing. Experience it. Get your anger out. And so people will bring that stuff up to me. Isn't that what you're, that's kind of what you're talking about, right? I'm like, no, because the opposite of repression to me, at least, is experience. So like you can go and bash all the windows that you want. Maybe you're then expressing your anger or your sadness or your rage or whatever. But you're not experiencing it unless, of course, you're having a visceral response while you swing that sledgehammer, which I mean, I don't know about you. That would be very hard to do, actually experience it while you're doing something like that. Because for me, I need to have, like I said earlier, 2 or 3 minutes of like a somatic exercise, which some people may just call, maybe it's what most people call meditation. That could just be the same thing. But it's like, it is a swirling that feels like it's going to be an anxiety attack that will kill me. And as long as I can hang in there, it literally just fizzles out like a fire at a campground. And then once it disappears, my pain is gone, if not all gone, most gone. And I feel exhausted. And then I sleep like a rock. Like it's pretty awesome, actually.
Yeah, in ISTDP, we actually talk about people not using physical discharge as a way of releasing the anxiety that they feel as an emotion rises, but to sit and experience in a more deep way, the way you said, where you feel it in your body instead of discharging it physically. So I know Ellie's had her hand up. She has a question for you, Eddie.
Hey, well, first of all, thank you so much for sharing. I can relate to a lot of what you say in every class. I just feel more and more validated. So I'm loving this so far. but my question for you is, one of my main focuses is men's mental health, specifically in reaching that population, because it's, you know, stereotypically so repressed with emotions. And I'm wondering if you could just speak to that a little, if you've been able to reach men. I find personally that there's here, at least culturally, a lot of people in New York, I find, which is obviously a stereotype, but I find that it's just, I can't get them to go there, you know, to that abstract thought Certainly there's a few that I can like get on board, but it's, I find it's much easier to convince women or non-binary or what have you than it is for men. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that or experience.
Yeah. So one disadvantage of living in the bubble of the Pacific Northwest and Seattle in general is that mental health and that sort of thing, especially in men, is very much accepted here. Like it's just a, it's a thing. Guys talk, the guys go to therapy, guys, not everybody. And there's outskirts in different counties. Like I was, it's like night and day, the counties I was driving around in today, for my day job, like I could stop at one house, have this conversation with that guy there, and he'd probably punch me in the face and point a gun at me. And then I could drive 20 minutes away and this person would give me a hug and burst into tears and tell me about their whole life story. So, there's that. Although, the other thing too, is that for most of my life, most of my friends have been female. So I've never felt, for me personally, that holding things in, I don't feel like it's ever been a necessity, but I know that a lot of men do feel that way. And I think it is a tough conversation to have. I think that that doctor from UW, Dr. Harmon, who works with, they're all male athletes that play on the football team. I think that it's such a gift to have somebody in an authoritative position like that to be able to say to all of the, you know, 80 male testosterone, 20-year-old men that play football in a major university in a Big Five conference, like I think it's great that they have somebody like that. So I guess maybe the only other thing that I'll add that could be sort of a hero's origin story as far as this stuff goes, or like, you know, you go and watch Batman Begins and it tells the whole story about how Bruce Wayne became Bruce Wayne. For me as a little kid, I had three brothers, no sisters. And my older brother, we're sort of a Brady Bunch kind of family, where like different marriages brought in different kids or adoptions or whatever, but it was only males. I never felt like I couldn't, like if I went to my mom or my dad and like expressed how I was feeling about certain things at school or bullying or whatever, I would have never felt uncomfortable doing that. However, I was sort of paralyzed from doing that, I felt, because the brother that was older than me, in like the next one in order, he had so many issues with stealing and psychosis and that have now been diagnosed mental health issues like bipolar disorder and borderline personality disorder and a lot of these things that we didn't know when he was a teenager. And who knows, like in 1993 or 1994, would that have been easy for a 16-year-old kid to even get a diagnosis of? Probably not. So I witnessed a lot of infighting in the family. And because I saw my parents spending so much energy on my brother, I could not give an ounce of how I felt. That's how I felt, is that I couldn't give an ounce. So like, my grades were good. I was home at curfew. I didn't have any issues. I never drank. I still have never smoked weed in any way. I still have never had a cigarette. I didn't have an alcoholic beverage until I was 20. And even then it wasn't good. So I held that off until I was 21 or 22 or whatever. So I was very much like the really easy kid. So I guess it's tough, Ellie, for my part of the country and kind of where I grow up or where I grew up. It's not as much of an issue here, I think, I guess, is what I would say.
Yeah, Eddie, your story is really common among, you know, mind body, TMS, whatever you want to call them, folks. Growing up, I would say that fits neatly into one of four or five categories I see over and over. And the one is my older, whatever, or younger sibling, was the problem. And a severe problem. And boy, I was never going to, you know, let my parents suffer the way they did. So I kept everything in, stayed on the straight and narrow, overachieved. And often when you mix that with a young person who's naturally more inclined to be more emotional, that's a recipe for a lot of mind-body issues later.
Well, and like even still, like I don't really make that many, it sounds weird to say, but I don't make that many mistakes. I still have the perfectionist in me, right? Like that's a personality trait. And Sarno says throughout his books, you don't need to change your personality. And I'm like, well, that's great, because that'd be really hard to do. like to just straight up change everything about me and sort of how it is that I'm built, because that's just the way that that's just the way that it is. I see myself in a certain way and I sort of have to keep that up. But again, to me, like the greatest tool is just understanding it and knowing that, like, I don't know everything. I do feel things, but I kind of have to force myself to do it. And I'll tell you what, like, this, the knowledge and stuff that I've gained and the people that I've interviewed, I think has made me, as good of a dad, I think, as there really could be. I'm sure I have my moments, and I know I have my moments, but like my kids, when they, cause they, I mean, I can see it in my 7-year-old who will get symptoms of mind body in a way, right? She has, she'll get a stomach ache or she'll get a headache, things like that. And when we talk it out, those things start, you know, I'll ask her a few hours later, how's your stomach feeling? Still having an issue? And oh no. It's not, so I know that it's there and I don't need to be up in her face about it. Maybe when she's 17, right, we can have more in-depth talks about that. But I think it's an incredibly powerful tool to have as a parent.
Oh, it is. And, you know, to have young parents or even young clinicians, even if the parents aren't quite familiar with it, to be able to, you know, kind of introduce these ideas when someone's young, can be so almost life-saving to a person who might otherwise have a whole lifetime of in and out of the hospital and, you know, physical condition and surgery. So yeah, I think one of the main reasons I'm teaching the students that I do is to get the word more out to help people before this turns into something that has ruined their lives.
Yeah.
Well, that might be a good stopping point since we had planned to pause around 6 o'clock and take a break. Eddie, that was amazing, as always. As you can see, he's got, you know, his own really powerful story, but just so much now. One of my questions was going to be, who are some of your favorite interviews that you sort of learned the most from? We didn't have time to get that in, but if you want to, do you have any just off the top of your head before we, you know, that really when you left, you were like, oh my God, that was like revolutionary.
Yeah. So the Schubiner one is kind of when somebody asked me, like, what is the one to listen to? If I don't know anything about this, what is the one to listen to? And it's definitely Schubiner's. He's just so, he's perfect. he's just, he's easy to talk to, layman's terms. Simple guy, like you wouldn't know that he's one of the most brilliant people on planet Earth, but he is. Christy Weepy, who was the executive director of the Pain Psychology Center in Beverly Hills, and I cannot remember the name, but she's executive director of a new organization that they do the same kind of thing. She's a pain psychologist, but she was on the Boulder Back Pain Study. I've done 3 interviews with her. There was one that her and I did the Wednesday after the pandemic began that I think is really powerful because it talks a lot about people's predisposition for control. And I think that can be really beneficial to people talking about this stuff. And then there was one that I did with a woman named Michelle Hinsberger from January of 2019, I think. She came on and talked about getting married like August 28th of 1 year. And then her husband died like September 3rd, like on a freak accident, cliff jumping, jumped off a cliff into water, hit the ground, like in the water and died. And her and I were doing this interview 3.5 months later and I had no idea. So one of the things that she talked about was treating all of her pain, as there's a book by a guy. It's a great book. He self-published it. It's hard to find in a good format, but it's called, At Last a Life by Paul David. And it's entirely about anxiety, but like how he talks about it, your nerves and all this kind of stuff, like nerves as in nervous about things. But she said that she read this book, like she read Sarno's book. It gave her some relief. She read this guy's book and replaced the word anxiety with back pain across the entire book. So that solved her problems, was the way that he wrote it. So those are probably the most memorable ones. And that one also, like, normally episodes would do at that point in time, they were doing like 400 or 500 listens, on launch day. And then, you know, there's a few, you know, hundreds of listens that happened throughout the week. But on the launch day at that point in time, 3 years ago, it was usually around 400 or 500. And I can see demographics. Where are people listening? Are they male? Are they female? What's their age? What's their, you know, all the stuff. And hers, she's in Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. And there was like 3,800 people that listened to that episode on day one. And I think that because her ex-husband, or her, she was the widow, Because it was like a big local news story, but nobody knew any of the background. So I think it was just one of those things where, like, he was in the main paper. Everybody knew that this young guy died under these weird circumstances. But, like, what's the story? Who's the widow? You know, people are just, they're curious and stuff like that. And, but it was amazing. And her and I have kept in touch. We talk once a week probably since then. So those would probably be the main ones that come to mind.
That's awesome. So that gives you some, students here a nice, cheat sheet to go to if you're going to try to listen to some. So, Eddie's podcast has been something that I think the reason you read my or were directed to my article is because I mentioned it in the article about something I refer patients to. So yeah. I encourage people to do homework in between sessions. And one of them is staying immersed in mind body literature and podcasts and movies. And Eddie's just always, you know, he's got such a plethora of content now with so many experts. He asks great questions. He's, you know, it's actually not very easy to be a good interviewer. You know, it's not something just anyone can do, and he's got a real gift for it. So if you're working with people, direct them there.
Yeah. When I interviewed for this job, and they'd asked me, like, cause it, you know, sales directors and VPs of sales, like, they want to know that you're all in at 100% making them money and working for their company and all this. And so, like, what do you do for hobbies and stuff? And I told them I do this podcast, and I don't want them to think I'm nuts. So I don't get too far into it because it's such a in the weeds kind of conversation. But I said that, I do a podcast on human psychology, and I said, lucky for you, basically every interview I do is a really great sales meeting. Like, that's what it is. I'm getting the facts. I'm not trying to pitch them a product to buy. I'm finding out what's the backstory. What's the solution? What did you learn? And that's really, I treat every sales meeting now like it's a podcast interview. I've even had a couple of customers that, like, where I've mentioned it and then they ask about it, and then I'll get an email months later that say that they listen. So I don't know. It's spider webbed. It's pretty cool.